most original and creative talent in our business, would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles again, come to call for another visit.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
Well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. We have a quick podcast intro for you. This episode of Orson is Orsonless. We have no Orson here, but it is an interesting episode anyway, and we'll go right into that with, let's go to Kathy first. So, Kathy, what do you have to point out in the episode?
Thank you, Daryl. I found it interesting because the news reporter who fills in for Orson Welles is a fellow named Don Hollenbeck, who was a young fellow, had become a journalist, I believe, during World War II. Here in 1946, he's working with ABC, but very soon after that, he's going to become one of Murrow's boys, moving over to CBS News and Ed Murrow. And he had quite a reputation as a sort of an honest and hard-hitting and fair fella. And sadly, we know the most about him because of the challenges he faced. He was willing to do television broadcasts in the mid-1950s, opposing Senator McCarthy when McCarthy was at his worst. And supposedly he got such bad blowback from McCarthy and a character assassination from a New York TV columnist that the poor newsman committed suicide. Oh. And this comes out as a dramatic point in the movie. What's the movie?
Good Night and Good Luck.
Thank you. Good Night and Good Luck. So they use it as, thank you. They,
a very good film, by the way.
It's a superb film. And the filmmakers use it as a dramatic point of horrible things happening. But
it's got George Clooney in it. Wow.
Well, yeah. So, but I just thought, I was curious if how late into the process did Orson Welles have to abandon this broadcast, not appear? I don't think that Don Hollenbeck simply read what Orson had left for him. And yet, on previous time that Orson had to miss a broadcast, somebody, a journalist, just sort of read the AP headlines.
Right.
So on a previous Orsonless broadcast, we just got a mixer full of the news. I believe Don Hollenbeck here very carefully put together something that refers to Orson and uses sort of Shakespearean analogies a lot. It's carefully written. It made me admire Don Hollenbeck, although, as I said, I don't know right now who is exactly responsible for for the writing of this episode, but I thought it was quite well done.
It was more closely tied into an Orson episode than the last one where we had someone take over. I thought it tied in a little better. And I think it's interesting. Like I say, it doesn't sound like it's Orson's wording, but it sounds like somebody trying to get in that ballpark sort of thing. So Vincent, what do you got on this one?
Yeah. So I'm totally with you guys. I think that they had, whoever wrote this had a bit of time, and I'll explain that later. And I do think they were trying to channel Orson Welles. There are points in it where it's clear the author did not go quite as far as Orson Welles. For example, he lets Truman off the hook, you know, says like, oh, Truman doesn't like it and he shouldn't, but, you know, it's the best he's going to get, so it's fine. You know, there are a couple of moments that I thought, you know, Welles would be clearly rolling his eyes and like, that doesn't go quite as far. But, you know, there's been several times even in this commentator series where Welles has been, you know, quote, sick. Sometimes he shows up, sometimes he doesn't. In this case, though, you know, for him, I've said before, being sick means a lot of things. It could mean actual sick, it could mean depression, it could mean that he's busy doing other things. I think he's frankly busy doing other things, and he gave them a decent amount of heads up that he wasn't going to be there. And some of my evidence for that is, Welles is still wheeling and dealing with Around the World. It's going poorly. I want to just quantify how poorly it's going. They hadn't made any profit since the last week of June. So we're at more than a month of losing about $3,000 per week, which is the equivalent of $42,000 today. Wells has stopped taking royalties, and he stopped paying Cole Porter's royalties, and Porter is upset. And Porter, you know, rightfully so. And the other thing that's hard to give another quantifying about how poorly it's going. We haven't talked about this, but Around the World was on the same, was running at the same time as the original premiere of Annie Get Your Gun, happening at the same time. And that in comparison is getting double the revenue Around the World is. It's doing really well. It's basically what's attracting people on Broadway, but it's also on the original long end of the run of Oklahoma, which had been playing for 3 years. And so, and Oklahoma, according to my notes,
it's Where the Wind Comes Sweeping Down the Plane. But, that's
beside yeah, it's still making $10,000 more than Around the World. Wow. So Around the World is not doing well, frankly. Wells is trying to sign other deals. He's like signing up to be a give a one-man act at the Copacabana, I believe, or one of these, I have to look at my notes, one of these clubs in New York. Yeah, the Copacabana. He's trying to figure out King Lear. So he's just busy and things aren't going that well. But I will say, the other evidence that he's not sick is that he appears in Around the World the next day. So he does. There's not shows on Sunday, but he is there on Monday. And in fact, he's still doing political business because on Sunday, he says, or Saturday, he said, there are more people on stage than there are in the audience. So he's upset that it's not doing well. But on Monday, he gets off the stage at the end of it and he tells everyone in the audience to, quote, buy nothing. Because he's trying to encourage them to continue still. The strikes for OP. Exactly. Yeah. So he's still doing his business, not on the radio, but he seems just overwhelmed with other things. So, yeah, the theater is a continuation of the commentaries.
Yeah, that's interesting. Terry?
Well, Vincent, I'm glad you explained why you thought that this might not have been written quickly, that they had some time. I was before you explained that, and that's a perfectly plausible theory. I was going to say that Don Hollenbeck, who you know was well before my time at CBS, was a very adept writer. And one of the things that you learn in that business is how to write quickly. But he was also in the school of Eric Severide, I would say, journalist who was also a commentator on the CBS Evening News when Walter Cronkite anchored the broadcast. And so that's what he reminded me of in this. It was, you're right, Vincent, he didn't go as far as Orson Welles did, but still he had an elegant and strong point of view. I love that fable of the ostriches. I'd never heard that before. Did he make that up, or is that something known that I've just missed in my life?
It was I didn't know ostriches lived in so many different countries.
it was elaborate.
Yeah. But the Kathy, the columnist you mentioned who went after Hollenbeck for his attacks on Joe McCarthy was Jack O'Brien, who, by the way, was also very critical of Jack Parr, whom we've talked about in previous conversations. So he was, you know, he was hated by many.
Yeah.
And loved by some because he was a strong anti-communist supporter of Senator McCarthy. I think what most impressed me about this commentary, though, was, as you mentioned, Kathy, was his literary references. I mean, you know, citing passages from Julius Caesar and Macbeth. It was just, you know, he was a well-read and very elegant writer. And so I enjoyed that, regardless of the arguments he made, whether they were too strong or not strong enough. It was a pleasure to listen to this kind of passe form of writing and communication. So yeah, he's no Orson Welles. And yes, he had a tragic end to his life. He committed suicide after these attacks. But we were lucky to have him when we did. And exactly. I was very glad that we got to hear him.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And this is a great little piece of history in itself, just because of his piece in history. So I think it's great. And thanks, guys. And if you've ever wanted to learn more about ostriches, here you go. A great opportunity for you. We totally bring you our A game here. So anyway, enjoy this, and we will see you all next time for a very hard-hitting Orson coming back, and one that you definitely need to hear is the next one after this. So please come back. We'll see you next time.
Orson Welles, usually heard at this time, is ill today. Instead, you will hear Don Hollenbeck, reporter, war correspondent, and ABC News commentator, Mr. Hollenbeck.
Being called in on short notice to understudy for Orson Welles, one has the feeling of a mixed personality. A man from Mars, Dr. Faustus Brutus, Macbeth, the shoemaker on holiday, Citizen Kane, or double-dealing Dick around the world. As a garden varieter of news commentator, one gets a severe attack of stage fright, but one stumbles on stage and reads one's lines. And the first scene opens in the Capitol. In the words of Brutus's Portia, "I heard a bustling rumor like a fray, and the wind brings it from the Capitol." This afternoon, it brings an extremely confused and confusing story, the House and Senate compromise on OPA, which has finally been reached. As it stands now, the conferees have agreed to a 1 year's extension of price and rent controls, although ceilings will not go back on foods for a month, perhaps not even then. The compromise legislation provides for a 3-member decontrol board, which could determine whether to lift controls on individual items after controls are restored on August 20th. What it amounts to is this 3-member decontrol board will be empowered to overrule OPA. In fact, OPA won't amount to much except for its authority over rents. The legislation now goes back to the Senate and House for their approval, then to the White House. Although President Truman doesn't like the bill, it seems to be about all he's going to be able to squeeze out of Congress, and he's expected to sign the measure with reluctance. We've had 3 weeks now of a free market with the lapse of OPA, and we've had an opportunity to see what can happen to prices and supplies without controls. The compromise provides a complex formula for deciding controls for various food items. Among those on which the lid goes back automatically on the 20th of August are meats, dairy products, grains, cottonseed, soybeans, and feed products. But the decontrol board could decide before that time against restoring any or all of those items to price controls, or it could decide at some time after the controls have been restored to remove the lid from any or all of the items. As one can see, this decontrol board is going to be an important group in the nation's economy for some time to come. The compromise legislation provides that no more than 2 of its 3 members can be from the same political party. But the most authority is given the Secretary of Agriculture. He has the say-so about certifying each commodity in short supply over which ceilings can be maintained. The law says that by the end of the year, the Secretary shall recommend the removal of price ceilings from items not considered important to living costs. Whoever the OPA administrator is to be, he's directed to follow the recommendation of the Secretary of Agriculture on price adjustments or ceiling removals. And though the compromise legislation directs that prices are to be rolled back, it doesn't say how far. Presumably, the OPA administrator or the decontrol board will decide if they ought to go back as they were on June 30th when OPA went into limbo. In the meantime, during those 3 weeks, there's been a flood of goods from agricultural areas to the market. Never so much meat in a long time. Never at such prices. At Chicago, beef on the hoof hit the all-time high point of $26.35 a hundred compared to $21.50 in 1919. At Omaha, cattle and hog trucks lined up for 4 miles to the slaughter pens. Many animals died of the heat. But the big meat rush was on. The hurry up to share in the bonanza of high prices while the getting was good. At a few points around the country, consumers objected so strenuously to paying increased prices that they had to come down some. But that wasn't the general story. Average prices tell that. And at the end of this week, most steers were bringing $19 to $23.50. At the week ending June 29th, the average cost was $17.45. Anyhow, it's now up to Congress again to accept or reject or modify further this puzzling product of its conference committee. Administration leaders fervently hope that both the House and Senate will approve the measure and send it along to the White House for an unwilling okay by the president. But it's by no means a foregone conclusion that the battle of OPA is over even yet. The Senate is especially sensitive to agricultural pressure, and its members may be expected to show a lot more tenderness on that subject than will the House, whose membership represents more urban interests, more consumer interests. And these have been filling the air with protest at the rising cost of living. And, of course, there's always the bust to look forward to after the boom. Even if the boom goes under the lid right now, there's going to be a bust even of minor proportions. Somebody's going to have to get stuck for the high prices now prevailing in wholesale markets. And while the dear old consumer is the logical goat, some wholesalers and retailers are going to get caught as well. However, price ceilings are restored. They'll have no effect on products which have been purchased at higher prices during our three-week spree, the gap in price controls, purchased by wholesalers and retailers, that is. They're likely to find themselves holding a lot of goods and commodities for resale to the public and at prices which the public refuses to pay. Speculators who'd hoped to make a killing will be holding the bag, and some legitimate dealers who were drawn into the buying spree will find it somewhat costly, too. In the confusion as it exists now, officials are undecided what can be done for legitimate dealers who paid higher prices because of the end of subsidy payments by the government. Well, thus the bustling rumor, like a fray which comes and with a wind from the capital. And to go around the world, one recalls the opening of Act One, Scene Two in Macbeth, Duncan's words. What bloody man is that? He can report, as seemeth by his plight, of the revolt, the new estate. And the scene shifts to Bolivia, where there have been plenty of bloody men. Although censorship has been rigid, reports have been coming out telling of a serious revolt there, finally crushed after more than 100 deaths. Demonstrations have been held in La Paz against the dictatorship of President Villarreal, but according to reports reaching Buenos Aires, the government has won the upper hand now, although there are still stories of fighting going on. Reports from La Paz trickling through the censorship say that all business in the Bolivian capital remains paralyzed by a general strike, and that public indignation is extreme because police had fired on a crowd of civilian demonstrators during the disturbances. Our American Broadcasting Company correspondent in Buenos Aires sends along the information that President Villarreal has attempted to increase his iron grip on Bolivia by naming a cabinet made up entirely of military men, and that the key post, the Minister of War and Defense, has been given to a character named Lieutenant General Angel Rodriguez, whose career has some features of interest. According to our correspondent, General Rodriguez is identified by the American State Department Blue Book on Nazi activity in South America as a fascist and a pro-Nazi militarist. As Minister of War and Defense, the general is now the most powerful man in Bolivia. During the trouble 3 years ago in which Villarreal became president, Rodriguez's reputation as a Bolivian Nazi was so notorious that even his fellow conspirators couldn't stomach him as president. Well, it seems he didn't need the job after all. In his present one, he has more authority than the president himself to run Bolivia. The tyrant has shown his face. But that is rather old-fashioned tyranny. Our Congress has just acted to perpetuate military tyranny in its more modern form, in the control of atomic energy. The House of Representatives has taken action on the Atomic Control Bill, which now goes to a conference committee for the adjustment of differences between the Senate and House versions. It's a long way from the shape in which President Truman endorsed it after unanimous passage by the Senate early last month. And in its present form, it's heavily bound with brass. The major differences are over the voice the military shall have in control of atomic energy development and the stiffness of penalties for violations. The Senate's measure proposes a 5-member civilian control commission. The House says at least one, not more than 2 members of this commission be from the armed forces. The Senate provided for a civilian director of the Military Application Division. The House insists the director be a member of the armed forces. The Senate approved top penalties of 20 years imprisonment, a $20,000 fine for the giving away of atomic secrets. The House voted the death penalty for major offenses deliberately committed, intended to aid another nation to the detriment of the United States. But it's in the interpretation of the part the military shall play in the control of nuclear development that the two versions differ most. As passed by the House, the military could exert a powerful part in influencing the exact actions of the commission. What it amounts to is that in this latest achievement of science, we would practically be under military rule. We seem unwilling yet to take the lead in world control of atomic energy. This view is expressed by Representative Short, the Missouri Republican. He's been opposed to any legislation at all until, as he says, world conditions are more settled. As if world conditions could ever be settled in the air of indecision, suspicion, and bad will that seems more and more to prevail in world relations. We demand evidences of goodwill from Russia on our terms, without opening the hand we hold behind our backs. The Russians, of course, suspect our motives, continue to operate unilaterally, and the British do the same, and the feeling of nationalism spreads. It all reminds me very much of the story of the Great Congress of the Ostriches. At some time or other before the atomic age, the ostriches of the world communicating with each other however ostriches do, decided they must elect a queen. The ostrich is the largest living bird. To be queen of the ostriches, one can realize, is an extremely high honor, and one can imagine the fever of anticipation which spread throughout the ostrich world at the news of the coming event. The genus Struthio, with its two toes, shared in the preparations with Rhea, the South American ostrich, which has three toes, or maybe it's the other way around. And all over the world, wherever ostriches live, they made preparations for this great event of electing a queen. From the sandy plains and open country of Arabia and Africa, little groups got together for the preliminary balloting. These groups, or troops as they're called, come in sets of five or six ostriches, one gentleman to five ladies, and a good many eggs were allowed to go bad. The gentlemen ostriches were supposed to watch over them by night, but the political discussions were so feverish that they often stayed out very late in the Kasbah or at Shepherd's in Cairo, haggling about the matter. Normally, the ostrich has great solicitude for its young, almost as much as it has for its elegant plumage. But a considerable number of complaints of neglect were heard during the preliminary balloting for the queen. But at last it was done. The queen was named. A gorgeous creature, 8 feet high, weighing 300 pounds, without a keel on her breastbone, as a true ostrich should be, and of elegant plumage. She lived in South Africa, and in order to pay her the highest possible honor, the ostriches of the world decided to hold their congress in the Libyan desert. It seemed to be about as centrally located as any place they could decide on, convenient to the ostriches which lived along the French Riviera, the one or two which would have to come from the Regent's Park Zoo in London, or the Moscow Zoo, a rather longer trip for the ostriches of the United States. But they agreed that since few of them had traveled much, it would be fitting for them to make the trip to the old country. So from all over the world came the ostriches to the hot sands of Libya. They saw the sights of Tripoli and Algiers, but they didn't linger long there, heading to the hotter regions around the Tropic of Cancer. How many thousands there were, it's impossible to say. Even though one ostrich can distinguish another ostrich, I understand, I can't. And it became extremely confused because the ostriches were very convivial. They spent a great deal of time running around the sands, getting acquainted, making preparations for this great reception of their highly honored queen. She was to make a grand entrance on about the third or fourth day of the Congress. Just how to greet her, of course, was the big question. Some very special honor had to be paid Queen Two Toes, for that was her name. She was a Rhea, or maybe a Struthio. Just an ordinary banquet with everybody getting tight and listening to a lot of speeches wouldn't do, it was felt. The entertainment committee worked long and hard on the problem, and finally it achieved what it felt was perhaps a unique form of greeting. It was a plan which appealed to the whole ostrich world. The queen was coming up from South Africa on foot. It had been a point of pride with her that to be known as Queen Two Toes, she should show the ostrich world a burst of speed, and her retainers followed behind at a respectful distance. Well, the reception committee decided to greet her this way. At the moment of her arrival at the Tropic of Cancer in the Libyan desert, every one of those countless thousands of Rheas and Struthios planned to hide. They were going to give her a reception like no other queen ever got in this world. And so it was. As Queen Two Toes came lolloping up over a sand dune at the Tropic of Cancer in the Libyan desert, every one of those thousands of ostriches had concealed himself and herself, heads down, well deep in the sand of the desert, plumes waving in the breeze. It was a miraculous sight. At the crest of the sand dune, the ostrich queen stopped and surveyed the prospect. She hadn't known quite what to look forward to, but certainly it wasn't a reception like this. She'd dreamed of all sorts of fancy preparations with ostrich plumes and so forth, but this one had her stopped, and it confused her considerably. So she stood there on the crest of the dune after that long trip from South Africa, the thousands of ostrich plumes waving in the breeze, every elegant neck well buried to a depth of a foot or more in the hot sands. She stood and looked, puzzled. Then she turned around and finally, as her retinue came puffing up behind, she turned to her courtiers and, in a voice of wonder, she said, "Where in the world is everybody?" And being ostriches, of course they couldn't tell her.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard news commentator Don Hollenbeck substituting this afternoon for Orson Welles, who is ill. The American Broadcasting Company hopes that Mr. Welles will be back again with us at the same time next Sunday. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.